Second case for this morning, Aaron against Mall, 074004 and 08-2020.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Matheson and I represent Susan Scott, who's the appellant. She's appealing from multiple orders of the Northern District of Indiana, specifically orders denying her motion for summary judgment in this case and granting the motion for summary judgment by Merrill Lynch, another defendant in the case, with respect to interpleader. In addition, after we appealed from that decision, Judge Miller awarded Merrill Lynch attorney's fees of $63,000 with respect to the interpleader. There are basically four issues raised by the appellant. They can be summarized just as easily. We believe that Judge Miller's order granting the interpleader and denying my client's motion for summary judgment violates principles well established under the doctrine of res judicata, principles well established under the doctrine of collateral estoppel. In addition, the interpleader itself must fail. And all of this results from the fact that there is, in this case, as found by Judge Miller, a contrived or spurious claim referred to as replevin, which emerged on the scene after the case was over 3 years old and only after the federal case was stayed pending the outcome of a parallel determination in the state courts of Indiana, which resulted in a state court decision in 2006, which did in fact hold that the plaintiff in the case, Mr. Aaron, was precluded from pursuing what was characterized in the state court as an effort to execute on my client's retirement accounts in Indiana.
But, you know, I think the problem with your brief and what I'm sensing right now with your argument is that the question before the district court, the federal district court, was a fairly straightforward one, which is, were there competing claimants to this body of money that Merrill Lynch held? And if so, I mean, everybody understands that there was diversity jurisdiction, so it really doesn't matter if we're talking about Rule 22 interpleader, whether we're talking about 1335 interpleader, that's really beside the point. There were competing claimants to this bundle of funds. Merrill Lynch doesn't really care who gets the money. They don't want to be sued by somebody for paying the money over to the wrong person. So if they paid it over to Mr. Aaron, Ms. Scott or Ms. Mall, whatever she wants to be called, would have said, those are my retirement funds. You paid to the wrong person. You owe me. And if they had paid it to her, there would have been a problem. Judge Miller decides there are competing claimants to this body of money. And so that's a perfect situation for interpleader. So he enters a final order with respect to Merrill Lynch. They're out. They've paid the money over into the registry of the court. Whether you think Mr. Aaron's claim is a sound claim or a bad claim, whether you think her claim is a good claim or a bad claim, are merits-based things. They're certainly not so frivolous on either side as to divest the court of jurisdiction.
Indeed, they are frivolous, Your Honor.
I don't think so.
May it please the court.
If that's where your argument is, you've got a tough one.
May it please the court. The very same issue that was brought in federal district court had already been adjudicated in state court.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that state court judgment is a little bit different than the way you're portraying it. The appellate court in Indiana held that the clerk was not authorized to issue that writ in contradiction to the judge's order. That's what that case is about.
That's correct.
That doesn't deprive.
But when the federal court case began, both Merrill Lynch and Ms. Scott pleaded res judicata and collateral estoppel because they'd both been parties to the state court proceeding and were fully aware of Judge Gilmore's two orders, one dated January 13, 2003, one dated June 13, 2003. So from the very outset, everybody in the case knew that this proceeding was specious and would, in fact, result in the determination of the Indiana Court of Appeals that came in 2006. There is authority that you have to look at an interpleader at the inception of the action.
But the Indiana court eventually decides that it, I mean, it conceptualizes this as an in rem action dealing with power to direct where those funds go. And it says we are not the right people to do that. Either a federal court should do it or a court in South Carolina should do it. That is a jurisdictional ruling. That's not a ruling, quote unquote, on the merits that engages Indiana's laws of either collateral estoppel or anything else related to judgments.
May it please the court, I believe it is a ruling on the merits, at least in terms of where the assets are properly depositable.
But it doesn't make any difference to the federal court. Look, Merrill Lynch is under the personal jurisdiction of the federal court, and for that matter, it was under the state court. What theory do you have? What authority do you have to say that the district court from the Northern District of Indiana had no power to tell Merrill Lynch to come before it and do whatever it had to do?
Merrill Lynch started the case initially as a Rule 22 interpleader, and they also alleged that they were entitled to statutory interpleader, but they didn't, in fact, deposit the funds with the registry. The reason they didn't, as alleged in their complaint, was if they did, that would be a taxable event to my client. And consequently, they didn't want to throw my client under the bus because,
Merrill Lynch was also under the state court order at that point not to do anything with those funds, not to give them to anyone else.
That's correct, but I'm properly quoting what they put in their complaint. The Rule 22 interpleader ended the moment Mr. Aaron's claim ended. There simply was nothing left. There was no competing claim insofar as Merrill Lynch was concerned. So on or about 2006, when the Indiana Court of Appeals said, for practical purposes, this litigation is over in Indiana, there was no competing claim.
Well, I think you might be mistaking the existence of a claim versus the way in which claims are pleaded in federal court, because as I'm sure you know, there is no requirement in federal court to plead legal theories. So you can say, I'm under competing obligations to pay the money over, and the theory might be replevin, or the theory might be goods sold and delivered, the theory might be any number of theories. But in federal court, anyway, you don't have to plead legal theories. So although you've placed a lot of emphasis on the judge's invocation of the replevin theory, I'm not sure that this is a point in the case where that was inappropriate.
May it please the court. For interpleader, you have to have real and reasonable fear of competing claims.
And they do.
Here's the way the trial judge defines what he thought was the status of Mr. Aaron's claim. It says, Mr. Aaron argues that the writ of execution that was signed by the deputy clerk on August 2003, authorizing the St. Joseph County Sheriff to levy against Ms. Scott's assets, supersedes the LaPorte Circuit Court orders entered in January of 2003. And holding that the property moved from Indiana to South Carolina could not be ordered back to Indiana and could not be deeded to Mr. Aaron. Quote, he offers no authority for this proposition, and the court's own research has uncovered no support for Mr. Aaron's theory. So as of a date on September 27, 2004, the federal district court, the same one that found Replevin theory a year later or 3 years later, said there was not an ounce, not any merit to Mr. Aaron's claim. That's why the court stated and specifically said that there was a parallel proceeding going on in state court that would end it.
If Merrill Lynch had given the money to your client, is there any doubt that Mr. Aaron would have sued Merrill Lynch?
Pardon me?
If Merrill Lynch had paid over your client's retirement funds to her upon her demand, is there any doubt whatsoever that Mr. Aaron would have sued Merrill Lynch as the holder of assets that were wrongfully turned over, given the order that Judge Tinder just referred to of the Indiana court telling it was not permitted to do so?
I think that would have been a violation of the court order, and I think
that's
that
right.
They
so
would have.
So Merrill Lynch would have been sued, would have been in contempt of the court's order, in fact.
That's not the claim that was being brought, ma'am. Merrill Lynch.
And I understand that, but I'm telling you the various legal theories that have come and gone during this case are not the be-all and the end-all.
I don't think, with all due deference, ma'am, that you're entitled after a court of a sister of a state has made an adjudication to which you've deferred then immediately to rule in favor of Merrill Lynch by saying this decision precludes the claim against Merrill Lynch, which is what Judge Miller did, and then turn around in the very next breath and say, however, we're going to treat this cause of action as entirely different insofar as Ms. Scott is concerned.
But it's interesting that you characterize this as in favor of Merrill Lynch. Primarily, it allows Merrill Lynch to exit the case by putting the money in the court and letting your client fight it out with Mr. Aaron as to who's entitled to the funds. No one has decided yet
actually,
whether she gets the funds or not.
Actually, if they'd just done that, I wouldn't find that there was inequity here. But instead of just going with a rule interpleader, they actually convinced the court, notwithstanding what should have been the termination of the case, to allow them to proceed under statutory interpleader, although the case drifted on for 6 months with no deposit in the registry, and thereby caused my client to incur a $100,000 tax loss and give Merrill Lynch $63,000 of attorney's fees, even if she proves correct and wins this case. May it please the court, I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I want to save it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Pat Murphy, and I represent Defendant Appellee Merrill Lynch. Chief Judge Miller correctly ruled that interpleader was available and appropriate because Merrill Lynch faced adverse claimants to the accounts that it held in the name of Susan Scott. As this court correctly stated in Union Central decision cited in Merrill Lynch's brief, quote, the purpose of an interpleader bill is as much to protect a stakeholder from the expense of double litigation, however groundless, as it is to protect him from the risk of double liability. End
so
quote.
Why did Merrill Lynch change from rule interpleader to statutory interpleader? And what, if anything, does the record show about the tax consequences of that move?
Merrill Lynch did not change from one to the other. It pled both originally, both rule interpleader under Rule 22 and statutory interpleader. It pursued both. Judge Miller ruled early on in the case that rule interpleader was appropriate because it did not require that the stake be deposited into the funds. There was a state court freeze order that barred Merrill Lynch from doing anything with the funds, so Merrill Lynch could not, when it filed its interpleader claims, deposit that stake into the federal court because of the state court freeze order. It was only after that freeze order was lifted that Merrill Lynch was allowed to deposit the funds into the federal court, at which time both rule interpleader and statutory interpleader were available and appropriate.
But these are, of course, restricted funds, and there are tax consequences to liquidating early. So what has happened with respect? I mean, it seems like a waste of money for no matter who, for whether it's Ms. Scott or whether it's Mr. Aaron.
Whether there's a tax liability, first of all, depends on the nature of the funds. It was determined in the state court appeal, the first appeal, that those funds were subject to execution. They were not exempt from execution. And that Indiana law controlled the issue of whether they were exempt or not. So regardless, the fact is Merrill Lynch faced adverse claimants. It held a stake that it conceded it did not have an interest in, and then appropriately deposited those funds into the federal court, thereby allowing Merrill Lynch to...
All this started with a fight among some lawyers in a law firm?
That's right. Jim Aaron sued...
I'm glad I escaped to the federal bench.
That's right. Jim Aaron sued Susan Scott in California and received a judgment for $1 million. Jim Aaron then took that judgment and domesticated in Indiana and in South Carolina.
Is anything happening in South Carolina that we should know about?
Merrill Lynch was not a party to the South Carolina action. It's my understanding that the South Carolina action is still in the appellate stage in South Carolina. But Merrill Lynch was not a party.
But the Merrill Lynch funds are not among the things that are being sought in South Carolina?
I'm not sure.
Seems like you'd have an interest in that since you've paid them into the federal district court's registry in South Bend.
Well, again, Merrill Lynch was not a party to the South Carolina action, but I assume that part of the relief that Jim Aaron is seeking in South Carolina is parallel to the relief sought in state court in Indiana, and that is, namely, we want the funds, among other assets that Susan Scott may have in South Carolina. Merrill Lynch, as a stakeholder, faced multiple vexation directed at a single account. It spent 5 years embroiled in a fight between Jim Aaron and Susan Scott as to who belonged to the funds. It was actually sued in federal court. It was a defendant in the federal action. That's the best indication that there was an adverse claim by Jim Aaron, is the fact that Jim Aaron sued Merrill Lynch in federal court. This claim that Jim Aaron brought was not a theoretical claim, as Susan Scott asserts. Jim Aaron expressly requested in his initial complaint filed back in 2003 that the district court order Merrill Lynch to immediately turn over all of the property held in the name of Susan Scott.
This is the LaPorte Circuit County?
No, this is the complaint filed in federal district court expressly.
Oh, in the federal court. But the original case that Mr. Aaron filed was in the state court in Indiana, right? In LaPorte, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And Merrill Lynch was a garnishee defendant in that state court action. When Merrill Lynch refused to turn over the accounts pursuant to the deputy clerk's ex parte writ of execution, which was later quashed, then Jim Aaron sued Merrill Lynch in federal court and specifically requested that Merrill Lynch turn over these assets, this stake. So right from the start, Jim Aaron was pursuing a claim against Merrill Lynch and Susan Scott for this stake. That, again, is an indication that Merrill Lynch faced adverse claims to this particular stake.
And I take it his claim of right to these assets was the domesticated California judgment.
Correct. Not only the judgment, but I also think the state court sanction order, which sanctioned Susan Scott $100 per day for contempt for violating various state court orders.
Is that payable to Aaron?
I think so. I think the...
Didn't that $100 a day stop once the funds had been deposited in the federal registry?
No. As a matter of fact, I think the state court explicitly stated in its order when it lifted the freeze order that the fact that Merrill Lynch is now allowed to deposit the funds in the federal court will not absolve Susan Scott from the contempt citation, nor will it affect her ongoing sanctions for that contempt.
It's pretty hard for her to move those funds when Merrill Lynch has put them in the custody of the federal court.
The freeze order was lifted, but I don't think the contempt citation. It may have been cut off as of that date, but not. She was not relieved of the however many thousands of dollars she had incurred by
that
time.
I guess that's a little beyond what we can do.
As this court correctly indicated, Chief Judge Miller has only decided the first stage of interpleader. He has not decided the second stage, which gets into the competing merits to the state, namely, who's entitled to the funds. He's not even there yet. Ms. Scott spends most of her appellate brief arguing that her claim is better than Jim Aaron's claim and that Jim Aaron's claim is frivolous, has no merit. Those are appropriate questions for Chief Judge Miller to address at the second stage of interpleader, not now. He was not required to determine at this stage who was entitled to the assets. He was only required to determine at the first stage that there were competing claimants to the stake.
But you would agree, would you not, that if one person's claim is really frivolous, like somebody says, you know, I had a vision on a hill and those funds are really mine and therefore turn them over to me, that would not be enough to engage interpleader jurisdiction.
I would agree. In the Union Central case cited in the brief, this court used the word possible claims. In the Indianapolis Colts case, they used the words reasonable claims. But there is some minimum threshold which has to be met in order for the adverse claimants to really have a claim that rises to the level that puts the stakeholder on notice that interpleader is appropriate. I think in this case, clearly Jim Aaron's claim does rise to that level. Jim Aaron holds a judgment for $1 million that hasn't been paid. That Susan Scott has not paid a dime on. And that alone, apart from the contempt citation, serves as the basis for a claim, regardless of the merits, a claim that's reasonable enough to invoke interpleader. Contrary to Scott's assertion, the Indiana court did not decide, nor could it decide, that the district court lacked jurisdiction over the interpleader stake. The state court order of June 13, 2003 expressly states that although the state court did not have jurisdiction over those funds, that an appropriate federal court would.
I find it so odd, actually, that the state court, it's not my business to reform Indiana state law, that the state court would have had such a geographically specific notion of the existence of these funds. I assume they're an electronic entry on Merrill Lynch's computers somewhere, and that they, you know, no one has a suitcase full of money sitting in South Carolina right now that was moved from Indiana. But I don't have any problem with the notion that the federal court, having personal jurisdiction over Merrill Lynch, is able to tell it what to do with that electronic entry.
The arguments that you raised were raised in the state court, but the state court determined under Indiana law the place of the Susan Scott's domicile, South Carolina, controlled as to all personal property. That was the location, so to speak, of the personal property, including the account funds. Mm-hmm. But you're right, they aren't securities that have a certificate or anything. They're in some database, probably in New York or New Jersey, at Merrill Lynch's headquarters there. But under Indiana law, it was the location of the
domicile.
The domicile that controlled.
Well, if you want to save any time, was it your colleague going to argue?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Foster.
Good morning. Before I address the issues that I was hoping to address, the court's raised several questions, and I'd like to put my comment on them. But first and foremost, consistent with your question to Mr. Matheson, the Judge Gilmore consistently, and Mr. Murphy quoted from it, but consistently said he didn't say it couldn't be done. He said he couldn't do it. And to be very honest, you're preaching to the choir from the standpoint of his position that he had sufficient jurisdiction over the parties to order it frozen, to do anything. I argued he could ask Ms. Mall to come to his court and not let her leave until, since she was in contempt for having moved the accounts. But Judge Gilmore disagreed. And to be very honest, that what happened originally, I wasn't going to address it, but to give some explanation for it, is the original order that came down that the Mall cites to that the money can't be returned to the state. Actually, what was before the judge at that time was we had asked for a rule to show cause on why she wasn't in contempt, and we had also asked for the issue to be resolved about whether the assets were exempt. Hmm. and the judge combined the two orders together, found that Indiana law controlled, that the property wasn't exempt, and then said, and you can see it in the two other paragraphs, that the deed can't be ordered. Well, she had bought some property with the money that she had stolen from her former law partners. She'd bought some property in South Carolina. And I argued, as a way to purge the contempt, he could order her to execute a deed. Now, what did that deed mean? He couldn't say, because he was an Indiana judge, and we'd go to South Carolina with this deed and see what that meant. But that I thought he did have the jurisdiction to order that. With regard to the claim, starting in December 26th, 2002, a garnishee was served on Mr. Murphy's client, Merrill Lynch. It was served on December 26th, and that was significant because Maul makes an argument about what happened with regard to that garnishee. Well, what had happened was, between December 26th and January 3rd, some amounts were transferred. Under Indiana law, once you're served with a garnishee, you are liable to the judgment creditor for all of the amount. And to the extent that the money had been transferred, Judge Gilmore found that it was commercially reasonable that, because of the holidays, that a few thousand dollars had been transferred. That's what got resolved below and which got taken up on appeal. If the court has any other questions, anything else that I get into, I'm not going to have time to address. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Quinlivan?
Yes, sir. May it please the court, my name is Michael Quinlivan for the appellant. Let me just respond briefly to what we heard from Mr. Aaron's counsel a moment ago. That was about the garnishment proceeding. That proceeding resulted in a final decision of the Indiana State Court of Appeal, and it's over. There is no garnishment proceeding, and Merrill Lynch cannot face any real adverse danger or risk of liability because of that. It's over and done with, and it's the law of this case. But beyond that, Your Honor, I think it's important to recognize that we don't want to weigh the merits of any claims. We merely are pointing out to the court there is no claim whose merits are available to be weighed. Now, the writ of execution was void in the first place, but it's important to note that at the time the federal district court granted interpleader and ordered deposit of the funds into the registry, every court that had the issue before it had decided that the writ of execution was void and it should never have been issued. That's a quote from Judge Gilmore and a quote from the published opinion of the Indiana Court of Appeal.
I understood that to be on jurisdictional grounds, though, that the Indiana court, through perhaps its Indiana domicile rule, took the position that it simply couldn't tell people what to do with assets in the state where they're domiciled.
That's not really correct, Judge Wood. What the Indiana Court of Appeal decided was a clerk could not issue a writ when the judge had already made that decision. So in any event,
procedural ruling too. I don't see how that touches the merits.
Well, the only claim that was raised in this case in federal district court was that Mr. Aaron had a right to the specific asset we're talking about, the funds with Merrill Lynch, because of that writ of execution. And if the writ of execution was void, and it was, then they have no claim. And certainly by the time Judge Miller ordered deposit, all the courts had agreed that that writ was void. Now, just because there's a judgment against Ms. Scott does not mean that the judgment creditor somehow automatically possesses title to her assets. There's due process. There's legal procedures that have to be followed. The only way Aaron could...
Won't they be followed now that the assets are in the court's registry? She'll have an opportunity to defend her right to retain those assets?
Your Honor, there's no claim against those assets that's still standing in the state of Indiana or in the federal district court. There's litigation...
That's not what the federal district judge thinks.
But that's his error, Your Honor. He thought, as Mr. Aaron had said,
and that
there's
the ultimate merits of the claim.
Pardon, Your Honor?
That goes to the ultimate merits of Mr. Aaron's claim.
Yes, but again, there is no claim. He didn't state a replevin claim, and I understand in federal court you can amend and there's notice pleading. I understand that. But you'd have to be able to state a claim for replevin. He couldn't state a claim for replevin under Indiana law, which is statutory law, that says you have to have a right. You own the property, the asset in question. Clearly he didn't. It was Ms. Scott's asset. And he didn't have a right to immediate possession. Maybe he could have had a right to immediate possession if he had a valid writ, but he didn't. So as to the federal case, there's one claim against a single asset, and there's no basis for Mr. Aaron's claim. The rest of it can all be resolved in the litigation that goes on in her domicile in South Carolina, which is pending on appeal. But there's nothing left in Indiana or in the federal district court. What Judge Miller should have done is simply dismiss, deny the interpleader, Your Honor. And it's not the California judgment that was domesticated that gives a basis for a claim to the asset. It would have to be some legal mechanism, some procedural mechanism. There is none. None has been stated. The lawsuit was filed, the federal lawsuit was filed in 2003. No amendment was ever made, no attempt to amend, and no claim could be stated. Unless there are questions, Your Honor, I see no.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement.